Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll talk with Sasha Lilly, editor of a new collection of essays on catastrophism, why hoping for the worst isn't a very productive form of politics. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Mark Ames, author of the great 2005 book, Going Postal, on rampage shootings, the reactionary politics of the NRA, and why gun control alone isn't enough. Time is short, so no comments in the news today, except to say that if Obama really has accepted the notion of switching to a different price index to adjust Social Security benefits for inflation, he is a traitor to his political base and promoter of a war in the most successful and popular social welfare program this country ever produced. It may sound like a technical tweak, and you might hear some liberals making inventive excuses for the move, but it's nothing less than significant cuts to the benefits of people who can't afford it and who don't deserve it. It's awful. More next week. Okay, my first guest is Sasha Lilly, co-host of Against the Grain, heard in KPFA, and editor of a collection of essays just out from PM Press, Catastrophism, the Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth. Sasha is the author of one of the essays in the volume, along with David McNally, Eddie Yuen, and James Davis. In the interest of disclosure, I should say that I wrote the introduction. I should also say that neither Sasha nor I will derive any monetary benefit from promoting the book here, though she is married to the publisher of PM, Ramsey Kanin. It was my idea to have her on. I was honored to be invited to write the introduction because I think this is an important book about an important topic, the lure of disaster scenarios to political radicals, which leads nowhere good. Okay, here's Sasha Lilly. Welcome, Sasha. First of all, I think some people, especially those who haven't read your book, will hear something of the thesis and say, well, gosh, things are really, really terrible. How can you be denying this? You're not really denying that things are rather terrible in some circumstances, right?
Oh, absolutely not. We distinguish between catastrophe, which is absolutely real and absolutely present in our lives, in our times, and is generated by capitalism, and catastrophism, which is the notion that out of the ashes a new world can be born. And one can entirely see the appeal of hoping for that, given the catastrophes around us. But it's a shortcut that just hasn't worked out so well, at least for the left, in the past.
Well, I think among the catastrophes we can talk about are the left itself, and any notion of utopian vision or ambition. Certainly the left is not exempt from this critique, is it?
Indeed not. And I think that this impulse, which has a deep history on the left, wherever you look, within Marxism, within anarchism, within Maoism, there's liberal catastrophism, which I would put to the side, but of course that notion that every 4 years, if a Republican is elected, that it will spell doom for the world. But there's this deep, deep-seated tendency within the left to hope for things getting worse to create the conditions or simply mechanically produce a better society. But I think it's very much based on the notion and has become intensified in the last several decades because of the defeats of the left. And it is, in essence, a kind of politics of despair. It arises out of these defeats, and the reason for the defeats of these social movements and struggles is, of course, very complex and can't just be simplified. But there is an assumption then that I think we don't need that kind of mass struggle, that we can find shortcuts to transforming society. So it's a kind of strange oscillation between a deep pessimism about the potential to change society at all, you know, what you were referring to, those sort of utopian hopes for large-scale social transformation, and then an oscillation to these sort of moments of expectation that you could find a shortcut through a catastrophe. And unfortunately, it doesn't work out very well, and it often leads to very bad politics.
Let's review the history of some of these tendencies. First of all, on the Marxist left, there is this long tradition of the falling rate of profit, the death agony of capitalism. You know, the rate of profit has been falling for so many centuries now, it should be below zero, although it's rather high, right, as we speak. What role has these played historically on the Marxist left?
Well, I would distinguish between two kinds of left-wing catastrophism. One is the determinist kind, which you've just referred to, the notion that capitalism will butt up against internal limits and come crashing down. And that has particularly had a great deal of influence, I'd say, within the Marxist left. Then there's also another version, which is a voluntarist notion that if things get worse, they'll be better for radical prospects. But staying with the former, I think a lot of it is based on a misunderstanding of Marxist analysis of crises and capitalism, and this sort of simplistic idea that the crises, which of course are endemic to capitalism, are, you know, a necessary part of capitalism, that one of these crises will bring the whole system to its knees and it will just fall apart. And, you know, that will be our moment, however badly organized we might be. But what, of course, is has been borne out historically is that these moments of crises, although obviously some capitalists suffer badly, they might go out of business during them, but are often really key moments of renewal for the system. And we've seen that now. I mean, I think when the economic crisis started 2007, 2008, there was some glee on the left, like this is, you know, that it's finally arrived, that capitalism has hit these limits, the system is unraveling, and we'll see it crashing down. But of course, what's happened over the course of the crisis has not been the disintegration of capitalism in any way, but in fact, you know, terrible restructuring. The crisis allowed an opportunity to push through things, I think, would have been more difficult in other times. And you know, as you say, profits are at an all-time high. So rather than leading to the demise of the system, it's actually helped its renewal.
Yeah, this is a system that has historically thrived on crisis, right? It's an opportunity.
Indeed it is. And I think that's something that needs to be thought about much more carefully by people on the left, that they see things which seem to be natural limits, and I think we should be sort of wary of that notion anyway, and they think that the system will hit up against these limits and tumble down. So the economic version is one form of this, but we also hear it around energy, and peak oil is certainly one place where this argument is made, that industrial society, industrial capitalism, will start unraveling fairly soon because of difficulties in accessing the more accessible oil reserves. And, you know, one of the things, Doug, that I think is so fantastic about catastrophists is they tend to put a date on things. They're not at all shy about putting a date on the demise of the system. So if listeners are familiar with Derek Jensen and the people in Deep Green Resistance, they have put the date 2015, which obviously is not very far away, for the unraveling of industrial capitalism based on peak oil. But, of course, what we've seen recently is, in fact, unfortunately, I mean, actually very detrimentally for all of us, rather than seeing the depletion of oil reserves and the start of the unraveling of industrial capitalism with the United States at the heart, you know, the United States in the next decade is set to surpass Saudi Arabia as the world's largest oil producer. So I think catastrophists tend to miss the frightening and incredibly destructive dynamism of capitalism. They seem to see capitalism as always kind of tottering. Often there's a tradition of Marxism that sees it as chronically stagnant. And by missing this dynamism, you really kind of miss the nature of your enemy. And I don't think that means that by recognizing that, capitalism becomes so formidable that we can no longer struggle against it. I don't think that at all, actually. But you have to understand what your opponent is all about.
Well, as a historical point, too, I think, you know, we talked earlier that the crisis might lead people to wake up. The scales will fall through their eyes. In fact, it hasn't always worked out that way. That crisis has not necessarily been good for progressive forces, and sometimes they've been quite good for reactionary forces.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would say that's actually tends to be the norm. That doesn't mean that radicals shouldn't try to organize during times of crisis, but an expectation that crisis will lead to people moving to the left tends not to be borne out. I mean, I think the iconic example that everyone looks to is, of course, the Great Depression. And without question, that was a time where all sorts of movements on the left blossomed. But if you look at the history of radical upsurge in the United States in the late 19th and 20th century, you're more likely to see the correlation between periods of economic expansion and militancy. Certainly the struggles that shortened the work week, the strike waves that eventually led to the eight-hour day, took place during periods of economic expansion. And that makes sense, of course, because people are more likely to strike, more likely to take action if they don't feel like they're about to be thrown out of a job or don't have a job. The last period of widespread radical organization during the New Left, the 50s and 60s, happened during a period of relative economic prosperity. And then when the crisis of the 70s, the last big crisis of capitalism, came along, you had radical groups saying, looking forward to the crisis, saying the 80s will make the 1930s look like a picnic. But of course, actually, if you look at the patterns of just taking strike waves during that period, which was, of course, a period of very significant rank-and-file militancy, very militant, it fell off once the crisis hit in 1974. Now, there was state repression. There were other things going on as well. But it does not bear out the notion that people during a crisis are going to move to the left. And, of course, what we often see is people moving to the right. I mean, even if you look back to the 1930s, in the 1920s, lynchings decreased. In the 1930s, they increased. And we see during crises that the right often does extremely well because it can very easily scapegoat. And you look to Europe or look in the United States, there's been intense scapegoating of immigrants. So I think we need to remember, we on the left, that in times of crisis, people aren't always going to act in radical collective ways that we'd like to see them act. Often they cope individually, people migrate, or they turn on each other and try and shut each other out. So that's something that I think is really important to bear in mind. And looking at the economic crisis, which has particularly hit Europe so badly, I mean, certainly we have seen social protests. But if you take a country like Ireland, which has been particularly battered by the economic crisis, you haven't seen at all an upsurge of the left or radicalism.
Also, there's a matter of pre-existing politics. In the 1930s, we had a very active Communist Party, which was at the core of a lot of the things that we remember of that period. Ireland, going into this crisis, had absolutely nothing.
Indeed, and I think that's one of the lessons to bear in mind during all of this, which is into a moment of crisis, whoever is best organized is going to do particularly well. And, that usually, particularly in the last several decades, that's not the left. That's the right. So if people don't take mass collective organization seriously, and of course it's hard, grinding, unpleasant work, it's much harder when these moments occur for the left to actually have an impact.
I'm speaking with Sasha Lilly, editor of a collection of essays called Catastrophism from PM Press. And speaking of the right also thrives on crisis in a different sort of way. How is it different? How is the functioning of crisis for the right different from what it should be or is for the left?
Well, I think that one of the things that distinguishes how the right functions here, and the right certainly has its own form of catastrophism. It has its own notion of a cleansing catastrophe being the moment where they can return to a mythical golden age in the past of, small town white America or whatever it is. They have their own version of catastrophe, or catastrophism rather, and catastrophe as a cure to wipe the slate clean again. But it works for the right in a way that it doesn't work for the left, because these politics are structured around fear and fear mongering, that essentially if we frighten people, we assume that they will then move to the politics that we have. But for the right, fear is really the terrain that the right operates on very comfortably, because they have no compunction whatsoever about pointing the finger and scapegoating particular populations, and they have no problem in calling for authoritarian solutions. Whereas obviously for the left, that doesn't work, and it shouldn't work. I'm certainly not advocating that. But we tend to forget this, that this kind of fear-mongering around catastrophe tends to tilt right. So actually quite a few moments of catastrophism, which have been picked up by the left, often actually originate with the right. One example is around, if you remember, the millennium bug or Y2K. This was the moment, of course, when the computers were going to melt down because they couldn't make the transition from 1999 to 2000. And you had people like Helen Caldicott saying, this is going to lead to nuclear Armageddon, as nuclear plants melt down, as governments lose control over warheads and machines start, sending nuclear weapons around the world. But this was actually a right-wing framework that the left slotted into. And this often is the case, that what gets offered up in these crises are sort of a right-wing survivalist solution, which emphasizes coping individually during a crisis, arming yourself, hunkering down in your bunker, and building walls to keep out your neighbors. Very unappealing to the left, but these are the kinds of politics that tend to thrive during moments of crisis because they're fear-based, and fear works really effectively for the right.
And speaking of right-wing origins of this sort of thing, I mean, the intellectual godfather of a lot of this scarcity panic, of course, is Malthus, who is one of the great saints of right-wing thought.
Absolutely, and of course, Malthus, whether people realize it or not, exercises a good deal of influence on people within the environmental movement, which, of course, straddles left and right, but a lot of people don't, I think, necessarily realize the intellectual origins, or more importantly, the kind of political implications of these ideas around scarcity. And they come up time and time again in people thinking about and organizing around the very, very real ecological crises that we're having to grapple with. And so just to be clear, we're not suggesting in this book by any means that the climate crisis is not absolutely serious and dire. But again, catastrophism lends itself to solutions which really are actually pretty alien to the left. And I think we need to be very cautious about that, a kind of unnuanced notion around catastrophe, and often the idea that you should just raise the alarm and then people will act accordingly and they will act in a good way, often misses the fact that actually the sorts of solutions that are on offer are solutions that come from the right, such as essentially, and Christian Parenteau writes very well about this in his fantastic book Tropic of Chaos, that there are plans by the Pentagon, governments, to seal borders and create what's sort of the equivalent of a gated community to do with the environment, to keep all the rabble from the global south out. And so environmentalists who slot into that really miss the kind of political implications that are embodied in that kind of catastrophism. And one of the things, of course, that it intersects with is this whole notion of austerity, which, again, we could trace to Malthus, but obviously is the logic of neoliberalism, that everyone needs to tighten their belts, that we all just need to take a cut in living standards to deal with this crisis. Although, of course, we realize that's not directed at everyone. It's directed at working class people. It's directed at the poor, people of color, etc. So without having a really nuanced, trenchant critique of how catastrophe and catastrophism are used, people on the left really fall prey to some very bad and very unsavory politics.
Now, let's talk in conclusion about the climate crisis, which is very real. It's no longer a future tense thing. It's upon us. But
The paradox is that I think a lot of people, a lot of environmentalists think that if you just recite the facts and lay out the gloomy scenarios, people will wake up and come to enlightenment and act. But in fact, it often has the opposite effect. So how do you deal with this? How do you frame a rhetoric and a psychology of a political strategy to deal with this real impending catastrophe?
Well, that's, of course, a huge question that we don't address in depth in our slim volume, but needs a great deal of thinking and debate. But as you say, it is absolutely true that a lot of people, contrary to what environmentalists believe, when they hear the details of how bad the climate crisis, the environmental crisis is, their response is actually to shut down. There's a number of studies that could be summarized by the headline, "The More You Know, The Less You Care," that have been studies of college students and others about the degree to which they know about the crisis and then what they think. So there's a sort of out-of-date notion of politicization, which dates in many ways to the 1960s. This is something that Eddie Yuen, one of the contributors to the book, writes about, that worked for a generation of people who tended to be white and middle class when they started seeing horrific images coming back, say, from the Vietnam War, and the facts, in essence, woke people up. But that was a very different time, and people had a very different notion of whether to believe their government. Our time is really different. There is widespread catastrophe fatigue. People know that things are bad. People don't need to be told that things are bad. The question is, what can people do about it? I think that's sort of the missing aspect or the missing element in this, is if you have all the information, but you don't see any movements to slot into, that you have any faith that something can be done to change it, then why should you actually engage in the horror of the environmental catastrophe, which, you know, the more horrifying it is. So it is a difficult question, but I would say that it involves shifting away from a politics that's based on fear to a politics that's based on hope, that can't simply be about stopping the advance of global warming. It has to be about much more. It has to be about redistribution, and it has to have a content to it where people feel like their lives will improve. Otherwise, I think people will and do separate themselves from it, especially when it seems to those who may delve into this to any degree, kind of going back to your last question, that the solutions on offer have to do with austerity and belt tightening. And, you know, we've got in the United States there, a third of Americans are living close to the poverty line. So what does that actually mean when you're being told this, the solution is we have to cut our consumption? And of course, you know, Americans are consuming way more of the world's resources, but it's a complicated question, that separating out consumption and overproduction. There's so much that's produced that's actually not consumed. 50% of the food that's produced in the U.S. is actually wasted. So sorting out this sort of middle class notion, well, we just need to cut down consumption, from actually something where there is an emancipatory element to it, I think is crucial. Otherwise, why engage in something that is just too depressing?
We have to recover some spirit of revolutionary optimism.
Absolutely.
I was Sasha Lilly, editor of a collection of essays just out from PM Press, Catastrophism, the Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Thank you.
Some of the Funeral March from Mahler's Fifth Symphony, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic under Pierre Boulez. Next up is Mark Ames. Mark was the co-founder, along with Matt Taibbi, of The Exile, a rude and great paper published in Moscow during the wild years of the 1990s. His 2005 book, Going Postal, from Soft Skull, is a terrific study of workplace and school shootings. He's now one of the editors of NSFWCorp.com, as in not suitable for work, NSFWCorp.com, a new webzine of polemic, satire, and analysis based in Las Vegas, of all places. After the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut last week, I thought it was an excellent time to give Mark a call. Mark Ames.
Welcome, Mark. Before we get to the most recent mass shooting atrocity, let's just talk some about the history of this. Your book, Going Postal, looks into two sides of this story, the workplace shooting, the school shooting. Let's talk a bit about each of these. First of all, the workplace shooting.
Right. So one of the things that inspired me to write this book was that there were these rampage killings going on in the workplace over and over and over. They began actually in the post office setting in the mid-late 1980s, then moved to the private workplace, and then eventually to schools. And every single time I noticed, I mean, I was in Russia at the time, you get a little bit of distance, and I just saw the same kind of canned reaction, but nobody got anywhere with it, and it started to strike me, having seen sort of the illnesses that come out of a culture that had been shocked economically, like Russia. I started to think maybe the problem wasn't sort of the psychological problems inside of the killers. I mean, when we look at serial killers, usually what we do is go back in their childhoods and find out these people were screwed up and molested and so on. But the people who were doing all these shootings were middle Americans over and over. They generally tended to be average Americans, anybody. In fact, they can't even be profiled. So that was why I decided to turn it around and profile the workplaces and see if there were patterns in the workplaces and then later the schools and the culture there. And then that led me sort of pulling the camera back and looking at what changed in America in the 80s that might have created these uprisings or little rebellions or shootings. And then it became pretty obvious that what happened, as we know, under Reagan was a major economic, political power shift in the workplace, starting in the workplace, you know, from workers, from employees, from even middle class, up to the very, very top 1% or the 1% of the 1%. We know it's now just a given, especially since 2008, and the crisis sort of brought this to the fore, that inequality exploded under Reagan. And it got worse under Clinton, and it keeps getting worse now because we're still stuck in one type of politics. And we also know that from studies, and it's also just common sense, that a greater inequalities, it makes for a worse life in every way. You have less power, and it sort of multiplies. You have less power, your life doesn't correspond to what the culture says your life supposedly is like and how great and happy it is. And what we know from studies also is that the greater the inequality, the greater the mental illness issues arise. So the book's basic thesis is that the change that happened under Reagan, which is a very violent change itself, basically stripping power from workers and from the middle class up to a tiny elite, created conditions whereby some people who in the past were not going out buying a gun and shooting up their workplace, shooting their supervisors and coworkers, or school kids shooting up their fellow students over and over and over. Anyway, that sort of violent socioeconomic change and political change that happened under Reagan and we're still stuck in, that's what's causing these shootings. And so in a sense, these shootings they're almost like peasant rebellions or slave rebellions. And in fact, that was another thing I did in my book. I went back and looked at the history of slave rebellions. And at least in this country, it tends to happen over and over that when the underclass or even when slaves sort of lashed out, I mean, there were very few, very, very, very few organized slave rebellions. Generally, they tended to be what appeared to people at the time, random acts of crazed violence. But we understand them now as political acts.
Also, urban riots, not unlike that in the 60s.
Yeah, exactly, and that was another thing. I was surprised, actually, because I grew up after that, and so when I grew up, it was understood that the urban riots of the 60s had a had an economic and political context to them, that it was understood that, that poverty and lack of empowerment, so political power, eventually led to this. Even if the looters themselves weren't consciously thinking politically, it created those conditions. But it took a while for sort of the liberal establishment of those days to get that. And, you know, I read one of those reports. I can't remember if it was a Johnson administration report or a congressional report. It was, and it came after riots in Cincinnati. And, you know, they're showing a lot of surprise, like honest, genuine surprise at how they missed this, that obviously this isn't some problem of sort of urban blacks. It's actually a problem rooted in economics. And then that becomes really dangerous, though. When you come to that conclusion, when you come to that understanding, it becomes very dangerous, because then you have to really question the whole order of things. That might explain the violence that went on, you know, from the top down after that over the next few years.
Maybe I'm a little nostalgic, but it seems like we're a little more open to questioning the order of things 40 years ago than we are today.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think also because people have become sort of so depoliticized or are mistaking, you know, Clinton politics for the Clinton era, stupid Clinton era politics, like the Clinton represents the left and Gingrich the right, or something, that people have been so kind of, I don't know, inundated with that really stupid frame that they don't even know how to. I think a lot of people want to think outside of it. And I think it explains why a lot of really frustrated people, younger people, turn to libertarianism or anarchism, because there's almost like this 40-year, 30-year gap of politics in a way. I mean, at some point the hippies just completely turned away from politics. I mean, they screwed up, and then they just turned away from it, and we've sort of been, I don't know, fighting culture wars ever since.
You open the book with this story of the Louisville shooting in 1989, which encapsulates a lot of these issues pretty nicely. You could just narrate that for us.
Yeah, well, so I moved to Louisville, Kentucky from Russia. I spent a year there in 2001 to start working on the story, to research it and to try to get an understanding of it, because, like a lot of things in our culture, these rampage shootings where it's worker who kills his own fellow workers or student who kills his own fellow students, that it started in rural, lower middle class rural America. And it turns out that before Columbine, one of the first really big school shootings that caught on, it was in Paducah, Kentucky. And in the private workplace, the first real big private workplace massacre was in Louisville, the Standard Gravure printing press. Which was attached to the Louisville Courier-Journal, which had been owned by the Bingham family. And what happened was, you know, I talked to these guys, and what I found there, and this, I find this a lot, and again, this is what differentiates the kind of killings that I write about from Newtown or from serial killers. There's a lot of sympathy for the mass murder, because everybody understood the conditions that drove him to murder. And that's a big, shocking, and kind of big censored part of a lot of these stories. This is not the case in Newtown, I want to make clear. And this wasn't a student who was bullied by these kindergartners and then fought back. It's just a sick, you know, somebody who's like really deeply sick and did that. And that stuff's happened throughout history in this country. So anyway, what happened in Standard Gravure, the workers actually had a pretty good life, the way they described it to me, up through the 70s, up through the early 80s. They had a very strong union. And, you know, everybody to a T said once Reagan broke the air traffic controllers union, once he broke that strike, power shifted almost overnight. Managers, supervisors, owners were no longer worried. They ran roughshod over everybody. The union got destroyed and corrupted. The union, what was left of the union there, you know, didn't help out this guy Joe Westbecker, who wound up shooting everybody. He was begging for help. And everybody who was left there was turning on everybody. The Binghams sold out to some vulture capitalist who wound up stripping the pension fund, stripping benefits, stripping pay. It just became a really horrible place to work. Westbecker was already, the shooter was already a bit unstable. And he finally couldn't take it anymore, and he got a gun and started shooting everybody and killed 14 people, wounded 6, killed himself. And again, you know, when you kill 14 people, to have fellow workers or even people who are there telling cameras or telling reporters, I understand what drove him to that, having sympathy for him, that's more like an uprising. That's more like, you know, an urban uprising or, you know, insurgency in an occupied territory or something like that, against a kind of an injustice that people can all sort of understand, than a serial killer just randomly shooting people. That's what I objected to. There are no such thing as, in these shootings, there's no such thing as a random shooting, because what they're trying to do really is kill the workplace or the school that they perceive destroyed them.
Yeah, as you say, it's the institution that needs to be profiled and not the shooter.
Exactly, and so there really isn't a random person, although in most of these shootings, Columbine included and Joe Westbecker's first big massacre in Kentucky that then sparked all the ongoing workplace shootings we have today, they do tend to have these moments where they see somebody who happened to have been good to them all along, and they stop, they come out of their supposed, you know, haze that they're in, and say, get out of here. And then they go on and continue shooting everybody else. It's pretty interesting, and it's kind of chilling, and it has a weird pathos to it. You know, that was one of the things that struck me about these stories. I didn't expect it. I mean, I'll be honest. You know, The Exile, as you know, I mean, we sort of specialized in black humor and satire and taking it as far as we could go in a setting in Russia in the 90s as horrible and violent and cruel as could possibly be. But so I initially intended to write Going Postal with a kind of black comic edge to it, and as I got into the material, I mean, there was just so much, it was the wrong way to approach it. It would have been frivolous, and you know, the pathos of a lot of these stories, the shooters and some of the victims, it really got to me. And it just didn't seem appropriate at all. And I was kind of starting to realize that a lot of that 90s black humor, in a way, was part of the problem, you know, that you couldn't actually talk seriously about this stuff.
I'm speaking with Mark Ames, author of the book Going Postal.
Now, the school shootings, the schools are, of course, a subject of a different set of disciplines. It's not the same kind of union busting and speed up you see in the workplace. So how do the school shootings, though, fit into this model?
The first thing I'd say is that I know this personally from what happened in my high school, which is a very good high school. Stress and pressures and bullying in schools now. I mean, there's always been bullying, granted, but it's much, much worse now. And the pressure starts at home. So, you know, your parents are dealing with a much worse sort of environment, workplace, so that already affects the home, and then they're pressuring their kids to succeed, and you're supposed to be on the fast track to success by preschool, or your life is over, according, you know, the way a lot of people think. When you have sort of the general setting from the top down, where shootings are a way of responding to powerlessness, you know, I guess it's just it all sort of starts from the parents and works its way down to the kids. And what we do know, what's going on in schools and with teenagers and so on, is that, you know, I remember at the time when the shooting started and people started trying to raise the issue of bullying, and then there were all these other people saying, oh, quit whining, they're just a bunch of whiners. But the reality is that suicide rates and attempted suicides among youth are up something like, I mean, the rates are up something like 500% since the 1950s. When a kid's shooting people and kills himself, that's not whining. That's about as far from whining as you could possibly imagine. And you can't dismiss it as a whiny kid who doesn't know what he's doing. I mean, this kind of thing wasn't happening before. It never happened before. What it shows overall, and I didn't want to try to perfectly, neatly fit a theory too neatly, because you can sort of go off the rails if you do that. But I think it does. It's kind of obvious, again, when you pull the camera back and you look at a culture that's gotten just a lot meaner than it was in 50s, 60s, 70s. It's a lot meaner, and there's certainly an enormous amount of inequality, unprecedented inequality, and inequality creates sicknesses, and it creates violent backlashes. And I'm sure from the oligarchy's point of view, this is just the price we have to pay for the, you know, for their liberties, for their increased freedoms and liberties. And this is the price that we're all paying, yeah.
And now the Newtown shooting, of course, is something different because the shooter was not a student at the school and had no connection to the school, really. So do you have anything to say about that, or do you need more time to think about it?
Now they're saying, right, that his mother was going to institutionalize him, but she was moving,
Yeah, that came out today.
Okay, it came out today. You know, again, that means we're going to keep learning more and more stuff about this. But what I would say is, you know, I wrote about how, because I've generally sort of tried to ignore gun control as the answer to this for a variety of reasons. One is that we've always had guns in this. I mean, I thought it's a distraction from the real underlying issue here, which is inequality. So we've always had a lot of guns in this country, but we've only had these kinds of shootings since the late Reagan years. And so if you think gun control alone is going to change it, you know, you're putting a band-aid on, and it's not going to change it. In fact, Clinton passed an assault weapons ban of some sort in 1994, when there was a kind of a mini Newtown in California in Stockton in 1989, when a homeless drifter, schizophrenic or something, went to a school in Stockton and shot up a whole bunch of elementary school kids, killed a bunch of them and himself. California passed an assault weapons ban, but the problem is, Clinton passed this ban in 1994, but at the same time, there were no politics that went with it. It was the politics of austerity and free trade, right? He's the one that later deregulated all the financial markets, and he didn't get the health care bill passed, universal health care bill passed. So he wound up just being an austerity, free market Wall Street president, and inequality exploded even more under him. So I think it's pretty clear. Gun control as a kind of culture war issue is a failure. And what I said is, if gun control is part of a politics, a completely different left politics, then that makes a lot of sense because on the right, the gun cult fanatics from the NRA, they understand the sort of the value of gun politics on their side and how it helps sort of feed all the internecine mistrust and hate and person against person rather than a sense of social justice and community. For them, gun politics works. And I think gun politics on the left side would work, but it has to be part of a much bigger politics about anti-austerity and redistribution of power, democratic power and wealth in this country. And Obama, his whole playbook is straight out of Clinton's. And that's what he's doing now. So he's promising, again, some kind of comprehensive gun control laws with the best ex. I don't know. He announced something today. But at the same time, he's going to cut Social Security. So it's not going to do anything. It's only going to increase it. I mean, gun control combined with austerity measures is just neoliberal fascism, for lack of a better word, just as flooding communities with guns plus austerity is libertarian fascism, which means just two sides of the same coin.
We're running low on time, so let's talk some about the NRA. Those are three letters that always come up in these conversations. So you did a very fine piece investigating the history of this thing, which is largely unknown to most people. Tell how the NRA turned into this enormously powerful right-wing juggernaut.
Yeah, I should preface it by saying, because I've said this in the past, that I grew up with guns, and I still like shooting them, but my whole life doesn't revolve around having access to guns at any time. So I'm pro gun control. In any event, it's assumed that the NRA has always been this absolutely fanatical. Again, because we've been dehistoricized, because we're so unhistorical or whatever today. And what I found is that, in fact, the NRA used to be, obviously they were very pro-gun and they were the main gun lobby and so on, but they weren't fanatical. They were almost more like a sportsman's club up until 1977 when a fellow named Harlan Carter from Texas staged a coup with these far right-wing fanatics, threw out the sort of the moderate head of the NRA at the time, who was a Mormon, by the way, because he was supporting a bill that was going through through Congress to outlaw Saturday night specials. If you remember those were the big sort of stick up guns that were popular in inner city crimes and stick ups of like stores and things like that, and they're very cheap. And so the NRA actually supported publicly the banning of these guns. And Harlan Carter and his guys said, you know, if that happens, then all of our liberties are in trouble. And they wanted to turn the NRA into this fanatical organization. Well, it turns out Harlan Carter had an interesting history of his own. He was convicted of murder in the early 30s. He murdered a 15-year-old Mexican-American kid. Was sentenced to jail and then got off. His dad was first of all, he's white, and secondly, his father was a Border Patrol official. And then Harlan himself wound up rising up to the chief of the U.S. Border Patrol, running a racket along the Mexican U.S. border, scaring Americans about subversives and so on and so forth that were getting through, and then rounding up Mexicans and then forcing them to pay him a fee, a deportation fee, and then busing them hundreds of miles away from where they came in from. I mean, the whole thing is really sadistic. And one of the operations he ran in 1954 was called Operation Wetback. So this is a guy who murdered a Mexican-American, who then made a living basically racketeering and extorting Mexican illegals, and ran an operation called Operation Wetback. And he today, I mean, he is to people in the NRA, he's like Jesus Christ almost. I mean, he's this mythological figure. And the sort of the irony is that in the early 80s, and so he created this, he turned the NRA into this absolutely bat fanatical cult. And they understood that the more fanatical and bat you are, the more kind of organizational power and bullying power you have in politics, and then the more money you get because you're so effective. But it was almost too effective. At some point, Harlan in the early 80s decided, well, here I am at the top of everything. Everybody thinks we're crazy. Maybe we should try and act slightly respectable once in a while. And he immediately got swallowed up, you know, by his own kind. He got tossed out for being a moderate, and other crazies took over.
But you make a point that they really have a coherent politics of kind of armed hostile individualism. They're really like they were very consciously opposed to the New Deal and any notions of social solidarity or collectivity.
Right. No, that's right. I went before Harlan Carter or you know rose to that point. I look back at what the opponents of the New Deal and opponents of social justice and labor politics were saying, and what they were saying, like this guy Merwin K. Hart, very big figure. I mean, he's somebody the right doesn't like to talk about because he was such a out and out fascist and anti-Semite, but very big, powerful figure in his day in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And I found some congressional testimony where he was telling people everybody should buy guns, arm themselves against collectivism, and just protect your own family, train your own family to shoot guns. And this is a guy who was very consciously trying to create a counter politics of individualism against what they called collectivism, you know, the collectivism of the New Deal. He wasn't alone. The idea of gun ownership and fetishizing guns, I mean, the politics behind it is that it gives people a false sense of political empowerment, as if they can hold off the f***ing American government. I mean, that's not going to happen. It didn't work for the Confederates. It didn't work for the Black Panthers. It didn't work for anybody. It doesn't empower you. But if you can atomize people and make everybody think that their little homes and families are each an armed encampment or a little fortress, rather than, you know, organizing together. I mean, that's the only way you can counter oligarch power is by organizing, collectivizing together. Obviously, yeah, so there's a real politics behind it.
Just to wrap this up, any kind of gun control politics that doesn't come along with the notion of social solidarity and justice is really not very desirable or effective.
Yeah, exactly. It's but that's what they're going to do. The real politics are the same, essentially, in both parties. I mean, one is worse, I think, you know, than the other. And then they just differentiate themselves. One is like gun control, but without anything else around it, just sort of gun control because we're more urban and we go to museums or something, you know, not gun control because we're in this together.
That was Mark Ames, author of Going Postal, an excellent book on rampage shootings, and co-editor of NSFWCorp.com, as in not suitable for work, corp.com, a new webzine on politics and culture. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more from the first movement, the Funeral March for Mahler's Fifth Symphony, performed by Pierre Boulez and the Vienna Philharmonic. Happy holidays. Until next week. Bye.